Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. If you've been keeping up with the disturbing current events taking place across the pond in the UK, then you know that the British people are currently embroiled in some rather shocking unrest, as the media like to call it, that was sparked by the truly horrific recent stabbing attack that left three little girls dead and something like eight or nine more wounded and quite possibly scarred for life, both literally and emotionally. That stabbing attack was perpetrated by a very young British-born citizen of Rwandan ancestry, and it was the final straw that opened the floodgates, if I may mix my metaphors, of pent-up British frustration and anger about uncontrolled mass immigration, a frustration and anger that had been building for many years among a working-class and middle-class populace that's been not only ignored by the globalist elites in power, but demonized by them for daring to object to the multiculturalist agenda. So rioting erupted, and the British government's draconian response was to clamp down hard in ways that were never applied in previous instances of unrest, like the recent and repeated mass anti-Semitic demonstrations in support of the terror group Hamas in the wake of its savage October 7th attack in Israel. So the British people, boiling over with justified outrage, are currently facing not only the economic and social consequences of an ongoing tsunami of mass immigration that they never agreed to, but a totalitarian government that has openly vowed to punish any protesters and even bystanders at protests or rioting, and that has vowed to strangle free speech in order to silence the legitimate concerns of its citizens. This is a terrible turn of events for the future of the UK and of Europe in the larger sense, but don't think it has nothing to do with us in the States. In fact, my guest today, who is very well positioned to offer up some insightful observations that will, I hope, convince you that we're all in the same boat, fighting the same fight, again, if I may mix my metaphors, and that there is a lesson for us Americans in what is happening in the UK. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a very interesting gentleman based in London who has had careers in the media and in politics and as an arts and culture critic, but perhaps most importantly, he is the founder of a think tank called the New Culture Forum, and I'm excited that he agreed to come on the show because I believe that he and the NCF are doing uniquely valuable work to rescue English culture and values from the assaults on them from various anti-Western elements. And also, I think he's a very vital observer of the upheaval that we are now seeing in the UK. Peter Whittle, welcome to the Right Take podcast.
Lovely to be here, Mark. Thank you for asking me.
Very glad to have you on, sir. Let's talk first about the NCF, the New Culture Forum. What is its mission and maybe a couple of its programs? And why did you feel compelled to found such an organization?
Well, yes, indeed. In about 2006, I set up the New Culture Forum. These things don't sort of happen just obviously, you know, sort of overnight, Mark. I think the thing was really is that it became clear to me that the most important issues of our time were cultural ones, or what we then called cultural ones. I think that's a bit of a misnomer now because they're the central ones. But at the time, it seemed to me that they were cultural ones. And essentially, there was the feeling then that the economic arguments that have really sort of, you know, characterized the UK for at least most of my life, had essentially been settled. You know, in essence, they had been. But that the cultural ones were very, very much to the fore. I remember at the time very affected by something which Andrew Breitbart said, which was that you know, politics were downstream of culture. That's become a very well-worn phrase, I know, but that was very much the spirit in which we started it. It was essentially, as well, looking at the West and Western civilization at a time when, particularly then, we were under very much an onslaught from radical Islam. You know, it had only been 5 years since 9/11. I should add, by the way, that I lived in America for 5 years until 2003. And so I had been there for 9/11. Around about the time we started the New Culture Forum, we'd had a massive terrorist attack here, which we then called 7/7, which was in London. And these things, and there was a sense as well in which there would be inroads into our freedom of speech being made because of the demands of Islam, radical Islam, if you want. That was the atmosphere in which we started. And basically, here we are 20 years later, and the organization has grown and grown, but the problems have grown alongside them, you know, and essentially the threat really to English culture, to the West, I would say, and indeed to British culture and history, now comes very much from within Britain. This is a crucial point. As from anything outside of Britain.
And having put yourself out there as a very vocal defender of English culture and a critic of mass immigration, how are you and the NCF viewed by the political elites in your country? Are you smeared like the David Horowitz Freedom Center here in the States is, as a hate group?
Right. Well, so far, I unless I am sort of deluding myself, Mark, it seems that we are considered reasonably, with a reasonable amount of respect, mainly because, you know, our standards are extremely high. I'm not saying yours are not, of course, at all. They can't quite seem to get us for being what they would like to call us, simply because we are very considered. We back all of our reports and books up with a huge amount of research. And as well, you know, we are very visible now. And, you know, therefore, obviously, when it comes to what you might call the liberal elites that run Britain, obviously, we are absolutely beyond the pale. And, for example, I used to do an awful lot of BBC appearances, things like that. Those sort of things, that doesn't happen anymore, because I think we've made our position very clear on the state broadcaster, too. But I think that, you know, essentially we are considered to be obviously an important body, and one that's sort of growing in influence simply because what we've done over the past, and I think this is one of the most important things, done two things over the past 5 years, really. First of all, was to take alternative media, if you like, absolutely grab it with both hands. So therefore, we have a very successful operation, a YouTube channel, which is, by British standards, extremely highly watched. And also what we've been doing over the past 2 years is building branches around the country of like-minded people. And these are people, whether it's in Manchester or Bath or any of the cities that your listeners might have heard of, you know, Leeds, Reading, Brighton, all of these cities. And that was came about as a call, really, because what was becoming clear was that people were getting in touch with me and with the New Culture Forum, particularly over the past, I'd say, 5 years, utterly bewildered and dismayed about what was happening in Britain, and feeling, most importantly, that they were very much alone. You know, that they were... You know, essentially, they sort of started to, in some ways, question their own sanity. I know that sounds, a little bit hyperbolic, but this is absolutely what I was hearing. And so we sort of thought, well, we've got to actually get people together, even if it's just purely socially, or indeed to be more politically active. And we've done that all over the country. That's increasing all the time. So I would say, in answer to your question, that we are not, you know, we're not, we don't face any bans. We don't face any of that so far, touch wood. But, you know, who knows with the future, particularly with the whole way now in which this government, the Labour government here led by Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, are seeking to cut down and suppress free speech.
And I'm going to get to that in just a moment, actually. First, let me ask you a more general, broader question. Conservatives, by definition, operate from, I think, a sort of a realistic worldview, which unfortunately sometimes descends into pessimism. And one of my frustrations as an American conservative is that I know many like-minded people who look at Europe and how it seems to be declining in various ways under these twin assaults of mass immigration and woke globalist leadership. And they say, well, Europe is lost. It's over with. Demography is destiny. And the combination of mass immigration and plunging birth rates means Europe is basically doomed. And this kind of defeatism really disturbs me. So I'm hoping you can refute these people and offer some hope. Is it too late for the UK or for Western Europe more generally to reverse course against these issues?
First of all, I completely understand that rather doom-laden approach. You know, it's very hard, Mark, you know, to actually sustain hope when it seems on an almost daily basis that you are being fought against and undermined as a country. I would be hopeful. I am hopeful. I wouldn't be doing this if I was not hopeful. I think the reasons why I am, of a number of reasons. First of all, should we say what might seem rather a superficial political one? And that is that in the 1970s, when I was growing up in Britain, I was a teenager in the 1970s, Britain was known as the sick man of Europe. It was known as what we call a basket case. I have absolutely no hope for it, that it was in absolute terminal decline, that governments at the time actually did have as a kind of policy the management of that decline. And that there seemed to be no hope whatsoever. And then what happened is that somebody was elected, i.e. Margaret Thatcher, who, whatever one thinks of what she did, utterly changed the game and the terms of the game. Now, we might say 3 decades on that, in fact, the rot was so deep that, in fact, a lot of that decline is actually, if you like, you know, become endemic, and that somehow, you know, that was a last hurrah. I don't happen to think so, actually. I think that there was an extraordinary change. I lived it. I was sort of part of it. Britain's standing in the world went up again. Economically, it became much more prosperous. So from that point of view, things can change. I also look to Europe, and I see the different parties, not reflected, by the way, I might add, in Britain, but the different parties that have come up across Europe that are called, you know, rather disparagingly populist parties, you know, but new parties that have, you know, we've had Geert Wilders being elected in the Netherlands, for example, that would have been thought extraordinary 20 years ago. So those things can happen and they do give one a fair amount of hope. And finally, I would say this, is that I was very active politically at the time of the Brexit campaign. If you had said in 2010, which is after all only 14 years ago, that Britain will leave the EU, you would have been considered a nutcase. You would have been considered crazy. Certainly it was a very, very marginal view. And yet here we are. Whatever you think of what has happened since then, it did happen. And I mean, I took enormous satisfaction and encouragement from the way in which ordinary people came out and participated in the biggest vote, you know, that in fact Britain had for, well, ever, actually. And so those things make me very, very hopeful. However, I'm only human, you know, and like many of my colleagues, just think everything is pitted against us. Our own institutions are pitted against us. As you say, immigration, which is just entirely out of control, is pitted against us. And indeed, you know, the sort of ebbing of a national spirit is against us. I have to remind your listeners, if I may, Mark, you know, that Britain or England can fit into Texas, I think, 2.5 times. I mean, it's a small place. To an extent, you see, when people talk about culture wars, America has a culture war, but you have, that, as the name implies, you have two sides. Britain pretty much had a rout, you know? I mean, everything pretty much was taken over by the left. And that remains the case. So in some ways, the new Labour government here is the political wing of that class of people.
I don't use the phrase culture war very often because I believe that in the United States, much like what you're describing across the pond, is that we have, conservatives have essentially lost the culture war here. And so we're not in a position to be waging a culture war. We're actually waging a culture insurgency at this point. That's how I view it. And also, I think of it more as a civilizational war than a culture war, because I think that's really what the stakes are at this point. Let me get to more immediate current events here. Peter, this horrific stabbing attack of children recently that sparked all of the rioting seems to have been the last straw for the English people. When there is rioting here in the States, its defenders always tell us that violence is the voice of the unheard. And I don't think there's any demographic in the UK and elsewhere in Europe whose voice has been less heard than that of the white working class. These people have been utterly ignored by the political elites for so long that the violence and anger we've seen, I think, were inevitable. Did they just think that the British people would simply continue to take this abuse and just go gentle into that good night, as the poem goes?
Well, I think probably perhaps they did. Or I think, you see, the other thing as well with this is it's not just that the British, you know, the white working class is ignored here. It is sort of positively has been demonized. I mean, you know, over a period now of, I'd say, 10, 20 years, but particularly since 2020 in the Black Lives Matter protests, particularly since then, actually, its history has been delegitimized and undermined. Its monuments, its belief in itself is constantly being deconstructed. And, you know, we see this on a daily basis when it comes to, you know, for example, popular artistic icons of England, you know, whether it's Agatha Christie, you know, the writer Agatha Christie, or whether it is particularly popular paintings of which in some ways symbolize Englishness. They are under attack. They're put up. They are criticized. They're deconstructed. This isn't what you thought it was. Obviously, what's happened too is that the fact that the British actually abolished slavery first in the world in the early 19th century is something which is almost completely ignored, instead of which we have this original sin, if you like, of basically being the successors to people who were slave traders. And every aspect has been used. And I would suggest that working class people suffer much more actually as a result of that sort of thing, that they need institutions much more, you know, and certainly when it comes to the economics, they do as well. But I would agree with you. It's changed slightly in that we now have a new party called Reform UK, and it got 5 MPs at the last election. And that is vital importance, actually, Mark, because it's like a foothold in the democratic procedure, You know, it's now, now there is a bridgehead there. But absolutely, I think what happened with the killing of those three little girls, and in fact, the stabbing of nine little girls, it happened at a northern town, which was where they were just gathering for some kind of summer dance event, Taylor Swift dance event, is that people, the atmosphere in which it's done, and look, I have to say this, but obviously there was some thuggery involved in this, you know, and you, the fact is, the violence obviously is not the way, but if one's going to try and explain, I would say, as you said, that in fact, we've had so many incidents over a long period of time, ranging from terror attacks right through to individual stabbings or surges in the general crime rate, and a constant sort of narrative that one should not say anything about this, and that, you know, one should not look for, you know, to look for higher or wider reasons. And people suddenly sort of, they kind of tip over. And I think that is actually what happened. I think what came after, which I think maybe we're going to discuss, but is equally as worrying. I mean, in the sense that the establishment, including, I might add, the conservative press, sort of pretty much went in lockstep, pretty much closed ranks to condemn all of it. Whenever there is any kind of riot, we've had, like we've had in Britain in 2011, we had riots with the BLM, you know, that there were disturbances or protests or whatever. Always we are told, but you know, as you said, this is the voice of the oppressed. And also for that matter, you know, we mustn't sort of, you know, as it were, tar everyone with the same brush. We should try and find context to see how these happen. No one is not condemning them, but we should see that. That was entirely missing this time. That was entirely missing. There was not even even the remotest sense in which any kind of context could be allowed or any kind of further understanding. The Prime Minister, which I thought was shameful here, it was a sort of occasion, usually, Mark, where people would say, you know, we utterly condemn the violence. We must also see what, you know, to try to understand what has maybe caused people to behave in this way to and address these issues. None of that. It was none of that. And that is very, very worrying going forward.
Yes, and speaking of tarring with a broad brush, all of the critics of these upheavals caused by mass immigration, they're simply dismissed as far right, aren't they? But these aren't issues of the far right, whatever the far right is. It's just a way to smear everyone, isn't it?
Of course it is. And in fact, on social media, particularly this happens, but I mean, just generally, what's happened in Britain over the past, I'd say, 10 years, is that the language, you know, has sort of changed. I'd say the terminology has been captured, actually. So therefore, one never hears of right wing, for example. It's always far right. You know, one never hears of, very rarely do you even hear the word conservative. It's basically become just far right. Almost any view that is not of the accepted liberal left or woke view, call it what you want, is now tarred as being far right. So being patriotic might be seen as being far right. Certainly the flag, the Union flag, would be seen as being far right. All of this is not shared by the majority of people, I might add, but the fact is the people who shape our cultural conversations, the people who shape our cultural landscape, are those sort of people. You know, there's been a tradition as well in Britain, and I think, you know, perhaps less so in America, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but, you know, George Orwell, who has been, the writer George Orwell, has been quoted many times in the past few weeks, but he famously said that the English intelligentsia is unique in the world in its distaste for its own nationality. Now, he said that in 1940-something. But what's happened is that we've now got a large class of people, if you like, you might call them the lumpen intelligentsia, if you like. But they basically are very much cut from that cloth. And they are the people in the positions of power. They are the people in our education system. They are people in all of our institutions. So, for example, just if I can give you an example, after the BLM riots or the BLM protests, call them what you want here, which very much focused on Winston Churchill here, in 2020, all of our institutions, including some of the greatest in the world, such as the British Museum, the British Library, these people, they all kind of came out with this same, this philosophical mantra, we must decolonize. We must decolonize our collections. We have to own up to our terrible past. These are our foundational institutions, Mark, you know, and they all came out with the same message pretty much at the same time. And it was sort of relentless, you know, and you can see it in our universities particularly, where essentially free speech is almost dead, right? So this is what happened at that time. Frankly, it is hardly surprising that the majority of people, if you want to call them working class or working and middle class, become very, very demoralized during, you know, over that long period. But it seems now that essentially not just decolonization, but even, for example, to be skeptical of migration, to want to see an end to mass migration, to be against multiculturalism as it being a very damaging policy. All of these things now they would like to see as being far right, you know. And I mean, people, the problem is, it's a little bit like with being called racist. Eventually, after a while, it becomes rather meaningless if you keep saying this, if you keep doing this. And unfortunately, it still has a very strong power. It still does have a strong power. They don't want to be called far right. Of course they don't. But they're not far right.
You mentioned free speech a moment ago, and I want to get to that in a moment. But let me ask you first about this very concerning threat of England having sunk into a two-tier system of justice. And I know you're very passionate about this topic. On the one hand, we have seen Muslim gangs roaming the streets, shouting Allahu Akbar and targeting people with violence in numerous cities and communities in the UK in the total absence of any police presence. And on the other hand, we have seen videos here in the States of elderly Brits being arrested in their homes on vague charges of having caused offense on social media. And this newly installed Prime Minister Keir Starmer, he's threatened to bring the full force of the law down on any British citizens involved in or even witnessing mass immigration protests. What would you like to say about this two-tier system of justice?
I'd add, by the way, Mark, that he hasn't just said that. Yes, you're quite right. People taking part or even just standing watching, but on social media as well, it will be sharing things which could be seen as inciting, as incitement. And that goes right back to my previous point that, well, what are you saying is incitement? If you're saying that this is the anger of working people, does that mean you are excusing it? You know, it goes on and on and on. With the two-tier policing, this has been a problem in, I would say that our police force here in Britain, we have many different police forces for the different areas of Britain, but essentially, I'd say that they are one of our most captured institutions. You know, when I was a politician on the London Assembly, which is like, how can I describe it? It's like a body with the mayor. Sadiq Khan is the mayor, and the assembly members are there to scrutinize him. And I was there, the police and their activities came up all the time. It became quite clear to me then, and I'm talking about 2016, that there was two-tier policing going on. And you had it, as I go back to the BLM protests again, we had the sight of policemen taking the knee to demonstrators, right? When it came to, for example, the Extinction Rebellion, which is the extreme environmentalists lobby here, again, treated very, very carefully with kid gloves, you know, treated very softly. On the other hand, when you had anti-lockdown demonstrations around 2020, you know, they were absolutely, or, you know, the gloves were off and people were treated very, very badly. That essentially is what we have seen this time around, but very, very vividly and very starkly. So I think now more and more people, the public in Britain, see it very, very clearly. The examples that you just gave, for example, you know, this sort of idea that somehow there is, you know, one way of being policed if you are an ethnic minority, for example, and one way of being policed if you're not. And it really did start to gather a kind of a sense of crisis around the Gaza demonstrations. As you probably saw, we had these week in, week out, from October the 7th last year, we had these disgusting displays of anti-Semitism, of extremist sloganeering from the river to the sea, was actually, you know, sort of projected onto Big Ben, you know, our Houses of Parliament. The police stood by and did nothing. They did nothing. And people crawled over our monuments, you know, defiled our monuments. All of this was somehow, it was all kind of allowed to happen. And people became very, very frustrated with this. But this was two-tier policing happening then. And all this happened now is that people can see it very, very clearly. For example, apart from the examples you just gave, there was another one whereby some Muslim people assaulted police officers at Manchester Airport quite recently. And in fact, yes, and a female police officer had her nose broken. Thing. The police sort of like hit back after that. And of course, it was the police that were in the dock for doing that. But the fact is that those people have now been identified, the original people who did the assault have yet to be prosecuted. They've even yet to be charged. I would say that the reason for this is it's like a form of management. It's a form of containment. In other words, don't do anything that is going to make them really kick off. Don't, you know, this. I felt this with the Gaza demonstrations, the pro-Palestine demonstrations, that there was this sense in which the police are outnumbered. They quite literally were outnumbered during that time, and they would admit as much. But also there was a sense in which, look, you know, there are 200,000 people on this demonstration. If we become too, you know, if we, you know, actually enforce the law, you know, there might be trouble. But they've really gone in with no holds barred on these particular recent riots.
Free speech in your country is at a sort of a tipping point now, isn't it? I mean, you've already got what are essentially de facto blasphemy laws when it comes to criticism of Islam. But Prime Minister Starmer is now threatening to take censorship to almost Orwellian levels, isn't he? Just to get back to Orwell for a moment.
Yes, indeed, he has. I mean, you know, it's mostly talked of in terms of social media. But it is the impulse, you see, Mark, it's the impulse of people like the current Labour Party and the people who are in their hinterland. Their whole impulse is to censor, you know. It is actually to censor opposing views. You mentioned the one about Islam there. This one is one I've really been highlighting now for a very long time, because people have got to try to know that this is happening. There is a definition of Islamophobia, which is pretty nonsensical. I mean, I don't believe in the term anyway, right? But the fact is that, you know, just give it the benefit of the doubt for the moment. There is this definition which was agreed by all-party parliamentary committee, some 10 years or so ago, or maybe not that long ago, not so long as that. But it's been adopted by the Labour Party. And what it is, and I'm just doing this from memory a bit, Mark, but it is, Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is hate, showing hate for Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. Now, really, it is as nonsensical as that. Right? But as you can see, and as I think you've already pointed out, that really does essentially amount to a blasphemy law. Essentially, it is, how possibly can you criticize either the kind of theological aspect of it and not be accused of Islamophobia, or indeed, as it says in that description, Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. So, for example, is the wearing of the burqa, a feature of Muslimness? You know, in that case, you can't be against that. Or, you know, you cannot certainly criticize the Quran because it's something that Muslims believe in. Now, this definition has yet to be enshrined in law, but I can't see any reason why it won't be. And that is a huge worry to us. Our hate laws in Britain, we have ever-expanding hate laws. In the 2010 Equality Act here, which was actually the very opposite of the Equality Act, certain protected characteristics were enshrined in law. So that meant certain ethnicity, sexuality, religious aspect. If you had these characteristics, you were sort of protected. And therefore, what that meant is it gave certain people privileges. You know, it gave minorities privileges over the majority. And so those have been expanding anyway, to the point where now there is a sort of confusion. People no longer really know what they can and cannot say. So they choose to remain quiet for the most part, you know. But I think that what we will see is a far greater adherence to the spirit of those hate laws, plus this new Islamophobia definition. This is extremely worrying. I mean, it's worrying to, I don't know, the likes of what we're doing now, Mark, talking, organization to organization, this kind of thing. It is very worrying. And if, you know, Britain was a place that took its freedom of speech very, very seriously. There used to be a saying growing up, when I was growing up, not just when I was growing up until quite recently, actually, called, people would say, well, it's a free country, right? It was just a saying. It was like, do you want, I'd rather do this, or I'd rather go here for the day. Oh, well, it's a free country, right? It's a flippant remark. You never hear it now. You never hear it now. And I think what happens is that people increasingly sidestep certain issues in their conversation. I mean, in their private conversation.
It must be hard at this point for the British people not to feel that the government is almost literally at war with them. Is a political solution to all of this even possible? Or are you just sort of facing an inevitable civil war of some sort? And let me ask you a related question, actually, because I remember this suddenly. Douglas Murray, whom I know you know well, said recently that he believes that the soul of England has been awakened and is rising up in outrage. I assume you agree with that, but how do you see that playing out? How can the soul of England be reclaimed and restored?
Well, I think Douglas is right, and obviously as well, not that he should worry, given his reputation and status. but he's obviously been under personal attack here in social media, as you might have seen, from some, you know, quite disreputable political people in our establishment here. And I think he's absolutely right. I think that I would in some ways echo what Douglas says, in the sense that it could go two ways. You know, on the one hand, it could be a sort of low-level disturbance all the time. Because, you know, look, I'm talking to you now. I'm looking out of the window. It's a beautiful day here in England. People are going about their business. And, you know, it doesn't seem like a country that's about to go into any kind of civil war. I would think what you might have is an increasing kind of atomization of population, almost geographic, you know, actually geographic. But that it would never be admitted that this is happening. I think it would be sort of, you know, it would actually just be sort of unofficial, but it would be possibly policed. My hope, I would not want to go that way. My hope is that what we have seen, for example, recently with the victory of Nigel Farage and Reform at this election. When I say victory, I mean they've actually got seats in Parliament. I hope this is the beginning of what will become a much wider movement, because they're the only political party that even talks about this. I mean, you know, Nigel Farage has actually been targeted himself. You know, the left call them the Farage riots, you know, utterly absurd, simply because he questioned whether we were being managed or whether the truth was being managed about these various incidents that have happened. Because the ones with the little girls, I might add, were just at the end of a whole stream of incidents that have been happening. And so he sort of questioned this, again, gets the blame. But in fact, he's a very influential politician. Reform is still quite new and young. I have supported it at the last election. That is the way I would like there to be a political response, as you put it, a mass movement of people, peaceful people. In some ways, I suppose, it's what we've been trying to do as well with the New Culture Forum in setting up all these branches. It's essentially to come together and to gain strength from being together, you know, and actually converting that into a political solution. Obviously, you know, it could go the other way. It's hard to tell at this stage. All I would say is that at the moment, it seems to have entirely just disappeared just for a moment. But I do think that what is happening is that, particularly I see it amongst young people, actually, Mark, that there is a growing anger amongst people who are young enough to only ever have known this kind of ideological regime. You know, they've grown up during a period where, and like all generations, they start to turn round and say, well, is it so bad that I'm a man, for example? Is it so bad that I'm a white boy? Is it so bad that what is so bad about my country? Why am I constantly being told this? And, you know, I know from my own everyday political work, you know, you've got quite a few extremely talented as well, younger people, I'd say in their 20s, early 20s, who are actually thinking along those lines. And, you know, that as well, I think, is a cause for great hope, actually, for the future.
A final question for you, Peter. I know that a lot of Americans probably think, well, what's going on in the UK doesn't really affect us here. It's on the other side of the world. Why should Americans care about this conflagration in the UK right now? Would you say there was a lesson and maybe even a warning for Americans in what's happening to you and your fellow British patriots?
Yes, I think, am I allowed to be a little bit corny for a while?
Please.
Yeah. I grew up adoring America, right? The American movies inform my life. I became a film critic for quite a long time, for example. I was going backwards and forwards to America. I lived in California for 5 years. It has been such a, it fills me with despair to see what you're facing in America. And, you know, when I look at Britain, it seems to be pretty much in lockstep with America. And it seems to me that, you know, one of the reasons might well be, and if this is a warning, it might be a little bit too late in the day, but America seemed to have had this way in which it had an overarching sense of American identity, and that people came into America from all different parts of the world, but they subscribed to that identity. In other words, it was a multi-ethnic society with an overarching identity. What it didn't have was multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is the European policy whereby people are told that they should absolutely keep every aspect of their culture, right down to the language, I might add, right down to not even bothering to learn English in the case of Britain. And it was absolutely the most divisive thing possible. You know, in other words, you keep your culture, you have a self-hating elite who more or less say to you, by implication, well, don't worry about integrating with us. We're terrible. You know, we're terrible. You know, keep your own culture. That was a big difference, as I perceived it, between Europe, Britain, and the US. My feeling is that somehow America has taken on that kind of multiculturalism, perhaps more in the guise of identity politics, maybe, but that is actually now what is causing, that would be my one, don't go down our route. As I say, it might be too late now. One thing, I mean, I would love to hear, I don't know whether your listeners do leave comments and things, but I mean, I would love to hear, you know, what you feel about, what I feel about America now, which is one of, I feel very sad because the things I loved about America seem not to be valued by, if you like, the dominant culture now in America. You can tell me if that is a wrong reading, but it seems to me that the patriotism, unselfconscious patriotism, the belief in freedom, the belief in America, the pride, all of those things have come under such attack and indeed have fragmented. So, you know, if there's anything I can say, just don't go down that road. Don't go down our road, you know. That is what I can say. But I see us fighting the same battle. I see us as fighting the same battles effectively. When you look at our universities, our institutions, you know, I cannot see the difference, really. What I would say is that in America, it seems to have, again, I'm seeing it from this, from across the pond, but it seems to me to be has been very fast, you know, the change seems to have been very, very quick, very rapid. And that's what that has surprised me. That's surprised me. But we are the same and we are fighting for the same things.
I couldn't agree more. I think we are fighting the same battles. And just to reciprocate with something you said earlier, I happen to be a lifelong Anglophile, and it breaks my heart to see what's going on in the UK right now. I do know and feel, anyway, that the best way to keep up with developments over there is to follow you and the New Culture Forum closely. Can you tell people how best to keep up with what is going on at the NCF and how to follow what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Basically, the best way and the most kind of immediate way would be to look at our YouTube channel, which is, you know, at New Culture Forum. On YouTube, you can't really miss it. We've got, you know, all the sort of people that you would listen to. Douglas Murray has been on many times. You know, we've had Farage. We've had people like Victor Hanson Davis, you know, a huge number of interviews and discussions and documentaries. But then there's also our website, which is newcultureforum.org.uk. And again, we're on Twitter as well. But the best, I think the best and most, you know, probably the most beneficial way would be to look at our channel, New Culture Forum, and see what we're doing there.
Yes, I'm a big fan of the YouTube channel. I follow it pretty obsessively, actually. Peter Whittle, thank you so much for coming to The Right Take, and keep fighting the good fight, sir.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Listeners, if you care about the fate, not just of America, but of Western civilization, connect with Peter in the New Culture Forum for some of the smartest cultural commentary you will find anywhere. And thank you, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.